From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. During all of World War II, the good war, the American military was segregated. There were black soldiers, black sailors, and Marines, but they served either in separate units or in substantially limited roles. The first African-American pilots were the Tuskegee Airmen, but the real story of the father and son who helped them reach that status and the decades of indignities they endured to do it is little known. Now, Doug Melville, their grandson and great-grandson, has come forward to shine a light on what they endured and how it impacts us even today. His new book is Invisible Generals, Rediscovering Family Legacy and the Quest to Honor America's First Black Generals. Doug, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for taking the time in that intro.
I want to start with the invisible generals about whom you're speaking. We're talking generals Benjamin Oliver Davis Sr., America's first black general, and his son, General Benjamin O. Davis Jr., an Air Force four-star general, also grandfather to you.
Yeah, so Benjamin Davis Jr. raised my dad from the time he was 7 years old. My dad is his nephew by blood, but Ben Davis Jr. didn't have any biological children of his own and really wanted to raise a son. So at the young age of seven, my dad moved down to Tuskegee and lived with General Davis and his wife, Agatha, and they raised him throughout his entire life, really as his father and father figure. And actually, me growing up, we just knew Ben as the center of the family. He was the nicest guy. He was the most loving guy. We always had to wear red around him because as a child, I didn't really understand, but it was always a red tie or a red sweater or red socks. And we spent so much time with him. And, you know, during our time together, I really didn't know exactly what he did. You know, he had no pictures in the house of the military. It was a very Asian theme, very into feng shui. He spent a lot of time stationed over in Asia and Taiwan in particular. And he really liked the serenity of it, you know, but he didn't have, you know, when you go into some people's homes, the medals and the honors and all the kind of regalia that comes with being a military officer. He was just, you know, the most loving guy and wanted to make sure I was good in school. And, you know, I could go on. I mean, he bought me my first golf clubs. He bought me my first car. And this is how I knew him. And then it was later in life that I found out that he was the commander of the Tuskegee Airmen, because it was just unspoken. Even in our own home, they were somewhat invisible.
You know, I think a lot of people became somewhat familiar with the Tuskegee Airmen when the movie Red Tails came out about the Tuskegee Airmen and their exploits. You saw that movie. You were happy that they got some attention finally. But there really was, if you watch that movie, there's something missing. And that's what set you out on your mission.
Yeah, it was. I was honored to be invited to one of the final screenings before the movie premiered. And at this particular screening, it was actually in Dallas, as a matter of fact. The actors flew in who were part of the cast, and many Tuskegee Airmen who were able to travel that were still alive flew in. And I had the honor of coming in to represent General Davis and the family. And we all sit down in the theater together with one another to watch the screening. And on one side of me were the actors, who I felt most related to. You know, they were younger and they were, you know, looking fresh. And then you had the Tuskegee Airmen who had, you know, were in their 80s, 90s, 70s, you know, oxygen tanks some of the men had, nurses some of them traveled with. So really two realities on either side of me. And when the movie started, I was really more on kind of with the actors as it related to my perception of how the movie would be. But in the middle of the movie, when they introduce Ben as one of the primary characters, he was played by Terrence Howard. The name was different. It was Colonel Bullard. And I looked around the room because we say Tuskegee Airmen, but most people can't name one. you know, so I looked around to see if anybody else, but I didn't know the other names of all the other men. So I didn't know if they just changed his name, if it was all the names. And afterward, I started to approach some of the people that put the movie together and people that were at the party. And I was asked, you know, what did I think of the movie? Because Oprah Winfrey was actually there and they had arranged for me to meet her because she was one of the people that was really a very big advocate for the film, for inspiration and all the things that it brings. And she'd asked me what I thought of the movie. And all I could think of, instead, my one Oprah moment where it's like, I've never met her and it's Oprah Winfrey and she's at the top of the game. And all I could think of is, was you changed the name. Someone in this party changed the names. And I went back afterward, after the end of the night, and I said, wow, I'm standing on the shoulders of these guys, but no one actually knows who they are. And the feedback given was that the movie wasn't a documentary. It was an amalgamation of multiple characters and things of that nature. But I personally looked at it as the one time we have George Lucas make a movie and you don't use the real names. That's how I looked at it. And I went home to talk to my dad, and my dad said, Doug, if you think changing the names is the worst thing that happened, let me tell you about what really happened. And that was when he really told me the family story. I was 31 years old. He had never really mentioned what Ben and his dad had done. He had never really clear that the Davises raised him. It was just all things that were unspoken. And he sat me down and go, let me tell you the story of what they went through and how he had to live like they were invisible. And that set me on my quest to find out and uncover what really did these two men do, and were they left out of anything? Were they actually invisible? And that started a 10-year journey, which led to me writing the book.
I want to call Ben Senior. I feel kind of bad. They did so much. You feel kind of bad. They call him by the first name. But Ben Senior, let's call him Ollie.
For the sake of not getting it confused. Yeah.
Now, he's born the decade after the Civil War. His parents are their rising black middle class. But even as a child, he wanted to go in the military.
Yeah, Ben Senior was adamant about going to the military. And actually, his father, Lewis Davis, was one of Ulysses S. Grant's son's babysitters. So when Grant got inaugurated for the second time, Lewis Davis, who was Ben Jr.'s grandfather, was in the buggy with the President of the United States and his son as they went down Pennsylvania Avenue towards the White House. So when Ben Sr., when Ollie was growing up, his dad wanted him to get a job in the government. Get a nice government job. They had the connection due to their relationship with the individuals who were responsible for hiring. So they were in some ways protected in a segregated DC because they had the cover and the advocacy of General Logan, who was their best, closest family friend. So you know him from Logan Airport in Boston and Logan Circle and Logan Square in Chicago and DC. So he was the best family friend of the Davises, and Ben Senior just did not want to work in the government. He said, I have to fight, and I want to be in the army, and I want to fight for this country, like physically fight, not sit behind a desk.
Yeah, he wanted to go to West Point, and he could have gone to West Point, but to do that, he needed an appointment, and that appointment, because of where they live, had to come from the president, and that was a problem.
Yes, yes. He needed to have an appointment from the President of the United States because he was black. And at the time, West Point was only a few hundred cadets per class. So when Ben Senior wanted to get into West Point, he was denied, even though he had General Logan wrote his application. And he was a senator at the time, as well as a general. So he would have been qualified to let him in, but President McKinley at the time rejected the application, and Ben Senior wasn't allowed to go to West Point, which was his dream. So he ran away. and he went to the Buffalo Soldiers. He took, I just imagine an 1800 taking a one-way train to Wyoming and essentially running away from home. I just can't even imagine.
Yeah, he becomes an enlisted man in the military, and which is far different from what his parents, if he had to go in the army, far different from what they envisioned.
Yeah, they thought it was beneath him. You know, they had a home in D.C. They had worked with the government and the president, and they had said, you know, if you're not going to get into West Point and go in the right way, you know, it's not really worth joining. And he said he ran away from home and told his parents that he was going to be an enlisted man. And they just thought this was a shame, really, to the family name and really to all the effort they had put to helping him be successful in the government, knowing what America was going through in a segregated time. And he just ran away and he joined the Buffalo Soldiers.
Yeah, you know, here's one of the amazing things that happened to him. You write that he ran out there. He ran into Lieutenant Charles Young, who is like the third graduate, the first black graduate of West Point, which is a small miracle because that's an important connection.
Yeah, Charles Young was one of the first graduates of West Point, and Ben Sr. or Ali met him in the Buffalo Soldiers and became enamored that this man had gone through the system and had actually graduated from West Point. And they actually, Charles Young became his mentor. And Ali was really good at equestrian and horse riding. So Charles Young had told him if he really worked on one thing well, you know, he would have a chance in the military. And that was exactly what Ali did. He really worked on being an amazing equestrian with the Buffalo Soldiers. And he saw that there was a way, you know, it was sometimes it was the smallest glimmer of hope, but you could see it. And that was the most important.
Yeah, he helps him to pass the officer qualifying test. Ali passes, he becomes an officer. He and his wife have three kids, but his wife dies when the youngest is born. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So what happened was President McKinley that did not sign him to get into West Point, after 2 years, saw his effort and recommended him through Charles Young to be promoted to officer, and then wrote him a letter that said, I saved you 2 years of your life, because it would have been 4 years at West Point and 2 years that the president elevated him. And that was 1901. And the next black officer in the entire United States was Ben Jr. in 1936. So when Ben Sr. Ali got promoted in 1901, the next officer that was black was 35 years away. So he got married, and Ali got married to his beautiful wife. And as they were having their third child, his wife died in childbirth, and he became a single dad with three children.
We talked about how Ben Sr. Ali becomes an officer, but he is not allowed to command white troops.
Yeah, and that was the real predicament that led to the integration of the military. But it was illegal at the time for black soldiers to command whites in a 100% segregated military. So when Ali became an officer, they didn't quite know exactly what to do with him beside teach ROTC military college. So he did that for many years and then asked for assignments overseas, because that was a loophole to allow him, because he was the only one. So it wasn't like they had to make an exception for many. There was a total of one. So they assigned him overseas as well. And he enjoyed overseas a little bit more. He was, you know, not under the thumb of the segregation and had a little bit more chance to breathe and perform. And that was how he was able to move up in credibility and actually get the opportunity to manage and command other troops because there was different ethnicities over there, as well as other black soldiers. So there was an opportunity for him to have some overseeing capability as a commander.
So he's kind of moving in the direction he wants. And then all of a sudden, at the age of 13, his son, Ben Jr., he gets this chance to fly with these barnstorming pilots. And he decides, you know, I want to be a pilot. But at the time, that's illegal for black folk to operate this kind of machinery. And the only place he can do that is possibly go to West Point.
Yeah, yeah. It was almost like history repeating itself, where he was trying to ease Ben Jr. He didn't have his mother, and he was, you know, doing great, but sometimes acting out. And Ollie said, you know, let's bring you on an airplane. And it was Ben Jr. really wanted to go, and it was $5, which was a week's pay. So it was 1 week's pay for, you know, just this quick ride. And his dad was very tight with money because they never knew, you know, there's no Social Security, there's no real safety net, you know, and he's a single dad, you know, so this is every penny counts. So it's 1 week's pay. And he comes down and he tells his dad he's absolutely sure he wants to be a pilot and is willing to do anything he can. And his dad had realized that the private sector was segregated and that he would never get the chance to fly in a segregated society. But the military would absolutely be the first to invest into airplanes and aviation. So he said, the one way that you can guarantee that you can be a pilot is if you graduate West Point in the top third of your class. And at that moment, John, just like Serena Williams and her dad, or I look at Tiger Woods and his dad, he went at you at this moment, raised him like he was in the military. Sit up, when you eat, what time you get up, all the calisthenics, all the tests, all everything, trained his son from the time he was 13 to get into West Point. And when it was time to go to West Point, he had to get a signature to get in, and you needed to get the signature of an officer, and you needed to get the signature of a congressperson. There was only one black congressperson in the entire United States of America, Oscar DePriest out of Springfield, Illinois. And there was only one black officer in the United States of America, him. So he sells the family house in Washington, D.C. His parents had since passed. Ollie sells the family house and relocates the whole family to Illinois so they could live in the district to get the signature to allow Ben Jr. to get into West Point. And then Ben Jr. takes the test and fails.
To go through West Point is 4 years, but he and his dad spent several years just preparing him to get mm-hmm. there, and then to have this failure happen. But it's not a failure to them.
No, it wasn't. Ben Jr. was so embarrassed. And actually, during the book process, I went back to see the letter correspondence between Ben and his dad. They're in the Smithsonian, and you can read the letters where he's like, this is a nightmare. You know, like, I failed. The Oscar DePriest was only signing in a few people, and he was the only congressman doing it, and he failed the test. But he said, that's okay. It was the mathematics portion. So he ended up going to university and studying for 1 year mathematics, and then took the test again and got in. So now it was the second time around. And, you know, sometimes you just got to do it twice, you know, John, sometimes, you know, that's life.
So now the story really shifts to Ben Jr. And I'm a military brat. So as a kid growing up, we used to hear a lot about Ben Jr. He goes to West Point, but it is unbelievable what happens to him. From the first time that he gets there, he shows up and they're going to assign him a room. Obviously, they're not realizing that someone black has been admitted, but he's going to be assigned a room.
Yeah, that's exact. So he shows up and his dad, you know, he writes that his dad dropped him at the train and they hugged in Chicago. And his dad was like, you know, you got this, you know, you're going to put the graduation date on the wall. And I imagine it as a father dropping a son off at school so lovingly. And then he gets there by himself and they didn't realize he was black. So they pull him into the commandant's office and under the sign that says duty, honor, country, they wait to assign him a room and ultimately assign him a converted room at the end of the hall. And he's rooming in isolation by himself with no roommate in really what would some would say was more of a janitor's closet, but it was a room, but it really wasn't for the intent. And he goes to bed that night and the next day they have a meeting in the sinks, an all hands meeting. And they discussed that they accidentally, you know, let a Negro into West Point and that they are to treat him as if he's invisible until he drops out. And this was faculty, staff, cadets, upperclassmen. And Ben quickly realized when he heard about the meeting, he called his dad and said, "Dad, you know, they just had a meeting." And his dad said, "You know, there's millions of Americans rooting for you. So write the day of graduation on the wall and don't let anybody at any time knock you off your mission to become a pilot."
Yeah, you tell this amazing story about how after that first day he gets there, everybody else is up and they're gone and he's trying to figure out where they are. He goes to the dining hall, tries to get in and the doors are closed, but everybody's in there talking and they're talking about him.
Yeah, and he was scared, you know, because they're around, you know, weapons and, you know, I mean, this is alive, you know, this is West Point. And back then it was really the greatest of honors, you know, in the early 30s in that part. So when he went down to the room, because he thought he didn't get invited because he was in a converted room. But what had actually happened is that he was intentionally not invited. And then when he goes down to the room and the doors are locked, he hears that the meeting is about him and realizes that, you know, this is, he has to essentially work around the cadets. And that was when he called his father and his father said, "No problem, just, you know, you can do it."
Yeah, because in the book you point out how his dad is telling, in all of this training to go to West Point, his dad isn't just going through the military procedures, going through some of the studying, that sort of thing. He's also trying to instill in him that, look, you're going to go through, you know, West Point has a silent treatment for people, for example, who may run up against the honor code. I think it's called Coventry. But he went through a whole lot worse than that. And his dad is trying to prepare him for all that. So this conversation that they have when he comes and calls his dad on the phone, he's pointing out that he's there representing every black person in the country at the time. I think it's like 7 million Black Americans.
Yeah, 7 million blacks. You have 7 million people rooting for you on the outside, and you have to pass. You know, he was the only one. I mean, I just can't imagine the pressure. You're 19 going to college, and you're told that you have to get through this. And at the time, it was 50 weeks a year.
Yeah.
So when people start not talking to him, it was for 50 weeks a year, 4 years in a row, he has no human interaction.
Yeah, he goes, if reading through the book, you find out when he goes to eat, for example, if you're a freshman, you've got to ask permission to sit at a table.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when he asks permission to sit at the table?
He would always share, you know, he never shared with me personally, because West Point actually in my family was something that we just didn't discuss negatively or positively. It was just, Ben always looked at it as it was something that I had to do to get to the goal. And if it wasn't for them, he wouldn't have gotten there. So he never spoke negatively or positively, but he would always say the experience was something that he didn't really want to discuss or relive because it was something that he had to do to get where he was going. But eating every day, three times a day, because you have to eat in unison with your fellow cadets. And when he was a plebe, a freshman, and you have to ask for permission to sit, no one would ever grant him permission. So he had to stand up with his tray until there was everybody got dismissed. And then he would run to the kitchen and eat the food in a minute or two and then join everybody else. And he had to do that 50 weeks a year, three times a day, stand with his tray, unable to eat it because no one would let him sit.
When he went in the classroom, did they call on him?
That was the only time they ever talked to him, as if he had his hand raised. And that was the one time that people interacted with him. And, you know, looking back, he would, my dad would say there had to be somebody wanting him to get through. But the issue was his dad was an officer. So they couldn't do anything too blatant because it was too obvious. But he would also say that because they left him alone instead of bullying him, it actually worked out for the better. The plan actually worked out for the better because he could focus and he was isolated, but he had to do everything by himself. He had to go to the Army-Navy game at Yankee Stadium in his own segregated bus because he couldn't travel with everybody else. And by the time he was his junior or senior year, there would be Black Americans waiting outside the bus for his autograph because he was becoming somewhat of a cult inspirational figure outside the walls of West Point.
People heard
inside
about him.
The walls, he still wasn't getting anyone talking to him. He would talk to people, they wouldn't reply. He was invisible. And it's a level of mind game that prepared him to lead and command the Tuskegee Airmen. But at the time, you know, it's hard for me to understand how anybody could do that. You can talk to anybody that goes to West Point now. They'll tell you it's hard enough to graduate when you have study classes and everything. So for him to do that in this condition is unheard of. It probably will never happen again.
At the end of the third year, he gets called into the office of the commandant. You tell the story. And I tried to look this up, and I may be wrong, but I think the commandant at the time was a general named Buckner, whose dad had been a Confederate officer, governor of Kentucky. But he asked Ben Jr., well, what do you want to do in the military? And he tells him he wants to be a pilot. And he is on schedule to be in the top third of his class. But he gets some bad news.
Yeah, and this was a big turning point for Ben because he thought if he got through it, he would be given the same chance because all the tests and the requirements are identical for everyone there. But when he went into the room to talk to the commandant, they told him that he was wasting his time because Blacks would never fly airplanes or operate heavy machinery. And they offered him a deal and asked him if they would be willing to send him back to Chicago and fund his law school career and help him open a legal practice if he agreed to honorably voluntary and honorably discharge. There would essentially be a prize that would be better than what would happen to him if he'd stayed in the military because it was segregated. And Ben said no, he wanted to be a pilot, and eventually you will need a pilot when the next confrontation comes. And Ben left that room discouraged, but still focusing on the goal. But it was very discouraging for him, but he still was focused because he knew there was a way. If there was ever a war to break out or a conflict, they would change their mind, but that would be the only way.
And it turns out that what he does once he graduates, what he actually does is he's going to be going to a lot of the HBCUs. Historically Black colleges, and he's going to be training cadets there.
Yeah, so on graduation day in 1936, when his dad shakes his hand, that was really when they became the invisible. They weren't generals at the time, but they were the only two Black officers from 1936 until World War II out of 355,000 men in the military, there was only two black officers, and it was a father and a son. But because they couldn't be in charge of whites, the military at the time put one white troop, one white individual in every black group of troops. So therefore, they could never command soldiers. So the only assignment that they could be given was to teach military science and ROTC at historically black colleges. At the time, they were just called black colleges, but today they're HBCUs. And him and his dad got in a Jeep, and for 4 years, they drove to all the HBCUs and told the young men, keep your head up, keep your chin up, stay positive, stay strong. One day, this country will need you. And they did that for 4 years.
So Ben Jr., he graduates from West Point in 36. They can't give orders to white troops, but they're going around the country to these HBCUs. But Ben Sr., Ollie, gets a call. This is an election year. He gets a call from Franklin Delano Roosevelt trying to get black votes. Again, an amazing coincidence.
Yeah, and this was the real turning point. And actually, when you look back at their careers, many of their accomplishments happened during election years when politicians and presidents were particularly looking to earn and keep the black vote. And, you know, we're 100 years removed, but people forget, after the Emancipation Proclamation, really Abraham Lincoln created the Republican Party. But most blacks, if not all blacks, always voted Republican due to the history and the connection with Abraham Lincoln. So Roosevelt was running on the Democratic ticket, and he was looking to get reelected. And he was very nervous because the polling was saying at the time that he needed to secure the black vote in order to win reelection. And he elevates and reaches out to Ollie and makes him the senior advisor for Negro policy in America. And with that role, he asks him what would be a way that they can leverage the military to ensure the black vote. And Ollie said, there's two things you must do: pay blacks equally for times and services spent in the military. And number two is you have to allow blacks to do all the roles in the military, and that includes flying airplanes. And that was when FDR said, well, who would lead that? And that's when Ollie said, my son. And there was a famous picture at that time of Eleanor Roosevelt, because FDR really wasn't sold on this, but he had talked it over and told his wife. So his wife, without permission of the president, flies down with Secret Service to Tuskegee, Alabama, and gets in the pilot of Captain Chief Anderson, who was one of the black training pilots down there, and flies around with him and invites the media to take a picture. And that was actually the one photo that spurred the president to allow the creation of a black fighter pilot training program. And then Ben Jr. then went and got assigned down there to be one of the first five black pilots in the United States history. He was the only one that had graduated West Point, so his rank was automatically higher. Two pilots didn't pass of the five that took the test. And then Ben Jr. was there as the commander of the other two. So that proved that blacks could fly. But then the next step, John, was the military said, well, there's not enough blacks that have been educated, because you had to have at least a 2-year degree. Yeah. Illiteracy rate was at an all-time high, and said, well, even if we started this, there's not enough blacks that would hear about it and be able to go down and participate. But because Ben and his dad had gone to all the HBCUs, they put out the call, and 15,000 black men and women went down to Tuskegee to apply to be pilots. And this is the prequel of the story of how the Tuskegee Airmen came to be.
And that's why it's so amazing that the real story, as you're telling it, is even more amazing than what you saw in the movies.
Yeah. I think the real story that it's a father and son, there's total of two black officers are making these moves with the president, the resources, the recruiting. And Ben Jr. at this point is in his early 20s. He hasn't been trained. He hasn't ever commanded anybody. He's been going to schools for 4 years. And now they land him down there and he's in charge of 15,000 people and overseeing the entire infrastructure. And then he has to battle, should he fly the plane or should he have others do it? Because if he gets shot down, the whole program goes away.
Yeah, I mean, even after the war is over, some people are following the black pilots around thinking that, well, they're going to have a lot of crashes and that sort of thing, and this will be over. But because of the level of training that Ben Jr. put them through, that problem didn't even exist. They were able to handle all that.
Yeah, they were the best pilots because they trained for 3 years in Tuskegee with some of the worst airplanes, but they had to take the training test every year where the white pilots took it once to become pilots and then they didn't have to do it again. But the blacks had to take it every year because it was a way to ensure that they would either fail, et cetera. And then the Army Media Department, which was started not how we would imagine it today, but they started following him around. And that's why there's so many pictures. If you go to the Smithsonian, there's thousands of pictures of him. There's hours of video of him because they were trying to get the photo and the video of the crash to justify their preconceived bias of the professionalism and expertise of blacks. There was something called the U.S. Army College War Report that came out in the 20s that said blacks were inferior and that they couldn't operate heavy machinery. So he literally by himself in his early 20s had to dispel this through performance. And that was exactly what he ended up doing.
You know, and their contributions don't end with the war or with the Tuskegee Airmen. 1948, Harry Truman decides that he's going to desegregate the military. And once again, at the forefront of helping all that, you hear the name Davis.
Yeah, so Ben Davis Jr. and Sr. and their performance in World War II showed through the wrap-up report that they created for the president's and for the Congress and the senators that segregation was very inefficient. During World War II, the parts of white pilots' planes couldn't be put on black planes. Everything was segregated top to bottom. And Ben Jr. thought this was the most inefficient thing that the military could do because we are fighting together. And he was in charge of a 15,000 person segregated Air Force. And in fact, John, the maps were even segregated. And Ben would always share with me that the reason that he encouraged the men to paint the tails red, because when he got a copy of the Allied map and they were stationed in Ramatelli, Italy, the base, because it was segregated, was on a separate segregated map. And he felt that the Allied forces would bomb the Tuskegee Airmen because their map wasn't, their base was not on the map. And there's even stories that the guys would say about when pilots landed there and didn't know what was going on because it wasn't on all the maps. Mm-hmm. So he had recommended they had red paint readily available. And he recommended to his men right before their longest flight of the war, right on 4th of July weekend, to paint all the tails red to ensure that America and the Allied forces would know that they were one of them. And that was the birth of the Red Tails.
Both Bens, Ollie the dad and Ben Jr., they both have this ethos, this model, this idea of how to confront, how to deal with confrontation. And you talk about in the book how they believe that you have to use the system to defuse the system. Explain that.
Yeah, so that was their superpower. You know, like in life, maybe you have a motto You have a driving force. You have a piece of energy that drives you almost as a religion. In some sense, it is religion. But theirs was use the system to diffuse the system. The system was set up to ensure that him and his father would not be successful. So the only way to dismantle it was to use the system against itself through performance. So they never acted out, talked bad. They didn't even vote because they felt that if they voted and someone found out, it would actually be used against them in a way that would hinder what they were trying to do. And what they were trying to do was integrate the United States military, which at the time was the largest company in the United States of America, if it was a corporation. So use the system to diffuse the system. There was a place for the marches. There was a place for other people, but their place was to use the system to diffuse the system and tell the men the only way to do that is through performance, not stats, not scholarly white papers, not other things. The system, performance, that's it, over everything.
That mindset, that helped your dad too, and you as well.
Yeah, and actually, so my dad also wanted to be a pilot. You know, he was around Ben and would grow up and sit in the planes, and he had really bad vision. So he actually was the head of the model airplane club for the black soldiers and built, you know, the model balsa wood kind of airplanes. And Ben was like, you'll never make it in the military. My dad's, you know, a little bit more of a pencil pusher. So he was like, your vision's not 20/20, so you can't be a pilot, and you're shorter and not really, you know, great on all the calisthenics. So he encouraged my dad to be to type and to work in the clerical part of the military when he was drafted, and that would lead him to become a judge. So my dad ended up going to Howard University. And when Vernon Davis was there, and there was a small group of civil rights attorneys, and Ben would say to him, my dad was the Army, I was the Air Force, you should be case law. And then my dad became a judge, one of the first black judges in the state of Connecticut. But funny enough, when Thurgood Marshall was still practicing cases to be presented to the Supreme Court, he wasn't a justice. Because the Supreme Court would not allow him to come in on weekends to rehearse, because even the courtroom was segregated, he would go to Howard and take students and have them set up and reenact, you're the plaintiff, you're the defendant, you're the justices. So my dad learned from him how to use the system to diffuse the system under the guidance of Thurgood Marshall, in the same way that Ben learned it under the guidance of his father.
I know that Ben Jr. became a four-star general, but Lyndon Johnson had a chance to give him his fourth star, but he did not.
Yeah, so Ben had done, he was commander of the 13th Air Forces. You know, he had drawn the line that separates Taiwan and China. It's called the Davis Line, the maritime line that still stands today. He had done everything that he needed to do to become a four-star general. And Lyndon Baines Johnson had spoke to Ben, even though it was scheduled to happen. You know, there's actually a newspaper clipping, first Negro to become four-star general, and a story about Ben. And it never happened because he told him that he already put Marshall on the Supreme Court. He had already passed Martin Luther King's civil rights, and there was no votes that he could gain by elevating Ben to four stars. And then he was essentially pushed into retirement, and he couldn't get a job in the private sector because it was still segregated. So he was trying to get a job as a pilot for an airline or, you know, FedEx, which had just started, and he couldn't get any jobs. And they decided to create a job for him in the Pentagon. That was just at the end of the hallway, just an assistant secretary of transportation. And he started looking at the problems of aviation in the United States. And it was during that time he created what is now known as the TSA, Commercial Airport Security. He created, led the creation of the U.S. Air Marshal Program, which was a state-funded program but wasn't federal. And after he did those aviation insights, he moved to the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit to help save gas and have a consistent federal speed limit. So even when he was out of the service, he was still working to improve America.
My guest is Doug Melville. His book is Invisible Generals, Rediscovering Family Legacy and the Quest to Honor America's First Black Generals. Doug, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, John.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Use any podcast app to get the Think Podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.